This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2017, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 4.
Well, it's not 2:50 yet, it's not even 1:50, but I suppose we can start. I've told my students already, if we start school at the beginning of the year, 10 minutes ahead, maybe we can leave out the year 10 minutes ahead. So let's... Are we all set to go? All right, everybody has a handout. This session is on the essential personal qualities of a teacher. And I begin with a question there. What is that in your hand? And using the analogy of Moses' rod, Moses was told to throw down his rod, and it turned into a serpent. And he was scared to pick it up. God said, no, pick it up and use it. This rod, it was just a shepherd's rod. And he had no idea how much potential was in this rod if God was in the rod. And God said, pick it back up. And when he picked it back up, it was a rod again. But as Moses went forth with the authority of God, he was able to lead the people. And the analogy there is considering yourself, considering the qualities that God has invested in you as a person. When God works through you and you step into the classroom, don't fear to exercise those things God has given you. The voice, the authority, the compassion, the love, the care, patience, and so forth. Some of the thoughts I'm going to be expanding upon are developed from a book, The Elements of Teaching. If you want to read the whole book, I think the bookstore has some copies there. It's written by two retired college professors. And there are certain elements of teaching that apply to all levels, whether it's preschool or adult. And these are qualities that come from within. I have a quote here taken actually from that book that says the human factor in teaching is infinitely variable and beyond the reach of scientific inquiry. For those who pursue it seriously, teaching is a calling, a summons from within. A summons is something that calls you. If you get a court summons, you must go and appear in court. If there's a summons, you must teach. Paul said, woe is me if I preach not the gospel. The teacher has a call. The basic elements of teaching are qualities that can rarely be taught. We want to learn, what can I learn so that I know how to teach? Well, there are some things we can learn, but there are some things that we must call from within. These rods, you might say, God gave you. Qualities of personality that have little to do with subject matter or theories of instruction. We don't learn these qualities, we call them forth. There are some things that you can't learn. It doesn't matter how many weeks you spend at Faith Builders. It doesn't matter how many classes you take. There are some things you can't learn. You must do. You must call them forth from within yourself. And we'll see what we're talking about here as we move into some of these qualities. Well, a few groundwork comments here, and I have an outline here that you can follow. Beginning with some groundwork comments that the teacher must be authentic. A genuine person, not an actor. An actor is a person who puts on a role for a while and acts like somebody that he or she isn't. And actors can be very, very real. They can seem real. The best actor is so effective that you almost think he or she is the character. In fact, the actor might actually convince himself that he or she is the character, but they're not really. They're just stepping into that position. And so one of the things to consider as teachers is, are we actually working in, stepping into this as ourselves, our whole selves. The art of teaching requires of the teacher a clear vision. And let me just divide here briefly between art and science. A science of something can be rather definite. There are sciences. There are, for example, if you, the billiard balls on a table, if you want to know where to hit that ball so that the other ball will go in a certain angle, it can be worked out mathematically. And if you can get the right speed and hit that other ball at the right spot, the other ball will go at a predictable place every single time. The math can be done. Now, you might not be able to quite do it, but if you aim right and do the calculations right, it will land there. And two people who can actually produce the same force will get the same results. An art is different. An art depends on the person doing it, on the artist. You can have the same recipe, and three different people can make the recipe, and it will turn out differently with each person. You know what I'm talking about? Because there is an art to it. And so while there are things to learn about teaching, when you yourself step up and start teaching, your teaching is going to be different from anybody else's teaching using the same book, the same class, the same school, the same room temperature, the same lighting. It will be different because you are a different person than the other person. That's the art. And that's okay. God made us each a little bit different. And that shouldn't scare us. And so the art of teaching requires a clear vision of who you are as a person. Who am I as a person? And how do I come at this teaching? Do I come at it methodically? Do I come at it with trepidation? Do I come at it with a lot of years of experience? Am I brand new at it? Who am I as a person? It requires an understanding of who the child is or the class. And if you taught a while, you know every class is a little bit different. And you can have the same subjects, the same books, the same set of materials that you use 1 year. And the next year you get a different class in, and things just don't quite go the same. It's a different group. Who ever had that experience with anything? All right, it's just not quite the same because it's a different group. And you've got to be able to adjust for the realities of the different group. And every class has its personality also. And then, of course, you have to have a vision of what is and what can be. This is the situation. If you're working with a mission school like Tidings of Peace in York, and you have a group of people from an urban area, and then you go another year and you work in a rural area someplace in Kentucky, or then you go to Lancaster County and work in a large school from some large Mennonite group, you have three different is's, three different situations, and you've got to deal with the realities of what is and then what can be, and have some vision of what can be done with this group of people. It can be the same set of books, whether you're teaching the third and fourth grade arithmetic, the geography, same set of books, but the situation makes a difference. And so regardless of your background, your training, your experience, it requires improvising. When you improvise, you make do with what you have. By the way, is there anybody who doesn't have a handout now? Okay, there's a couple of extras. It requires you to make do with what you have. When a cook needs to make a meal, she has to deal with what she has at hand. And if you're missing some ingredients, you improvise. And so you have to blend the personal resources you have as a person. What resources do you have with the potential of the students, with the given setting, and the available resources and materials? So what do I have to work with? Who are my students? And what's the setting? What are the circumstances? And what are the resources that I have to work with? It can be quite a challenge. Next week, I and a couple others are scheduled to lead a teacher workshop week in Democratic Republic of Congo with a school there. And basically there they have seats for the children to sit in. They have paper and pencil. And the teachers have a chalkboard and chalk. And that's pretty much it. And so these are the resources you have to work with. What can you do with the resources you have? And you have to consider the resources in order to teach. Here's another quote that from another book. Teaching is the art of weaving a myriad of methods. Now, you might have learned there are hundreds of methods of teaching. There's group work, projects, reports, debates, question and answer, quizzes, and so on. But you weave a myriad of methods spontaneously in the context of the moment out of the personality of the teacher. And depending on how the students respond to what you're doing, I came across this picture somewhere, and I think that probably each of those children is having a slightly different interaction with what they're talking about. They're focused on something about the globe. I think that one of those girls is primarily enjoying the interactive experience with the teacher. I think one of those girls is intrigued by something that caught her attention on the globe, maybe a rift valley or something, or an island sticking in the middle of the ocean that's caught her attention. And I think one of them is really engaged with with what the teacher is trying to point out and able to focus on the thing that's being taught. I'm curious whether the one I think is doing each of those is the one you think is doing each of those. Can you read the characters? And I could be wrong. But what do you think? Which one do you think is primarily enjoying the experience with the teacher, regardless of what the subject is? Yes. The one on the pink, you think? Okay. Which one is really fixated on something on the globe that kind of caught her own attention? Yes. On the left? That's what I think. And what about the one on the far right? Which she, I guess she's the one that's left. Now, as a teacher, when you're teaching a class, children's minds go all over the place. And that's just the fact of life. And so you have to be alert to that. And it's always somewhat of a dance or whatever. You have to respond to how they're responding in order to stay on track. Moving on, methods can be studied. Art must be imagined. You must imagine what you can do and practice it. It must be practiced. And I like to say a few words about practicing. When you practice something, I like to think of a doctor, an attorney, an architect, somebody who has some kind of a certificate to practice something. And he's recognized as someone who has a skill who can do this. And then he puts up his sign, and he's a practicing physician. And so when you go to the doctor and you present your symptoms to the doctor, he's supposed to be able to evaluate the symptoms and determine some kind of treatment for you. He doesn't simply sit down and fill out a prescription for everything in the drugstore, hoping that one of them will heal you. He's supposed to be able to choose the one that seems to fit you best, and then you go and practice either that therapy or that take that prescription. And the same thing with a teacher is a practicing teacher. And as you set up your practice and in the classroom, and children come and they begin their course of study, you need to decide, how do we proceed here? Out of these 17 or 18 methods that we could use? Which one do we use? When and how much? Do we have an oral? Is this a question and answer? Do we read this? Do we study it? Do you read it first and then we discuss it? Do we discuss it first and then you read it? Do we make a quiz? Do we have you read aloud? Do we set up some kind of little project? There are all kinds of things we could do, but a practicing teacher has to determine what I'm going to do. How will we proceed here? And as these elements that we'll talk about here are practiced, they have an influence on the students. So our first of the elements that we're going to address is simply called learning. And the attitude of the teacher comes through. We want our children to learn how to do their math. They want them to learn some geography, learn some history. But along with that learning, we want them to learn to learn. To learn how to learn. Because only some of life's learning occurs in school. Most of life's learning occurs either outside of school while they're going to school or after that. And along with all the things they learn in school, they should learn how. They should learn to learn. And if you're going to learn, who are you going to learn it from? It should be from a what? You tell me. A learner. That's right, a learner. And so are you the lead learner in your classroom? Do your students learn to learn by watching that you and seeing that you are, in fact, a learner? Can they pick up, can they catch, is your learning infectious that they can catch it from you? And there are a couple of scriptures I think of. In Proverbs 2, we read that knowledge is pleasant to the soul. And we know there are scriptures that talk about those people who are ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. It is possible to come to the knowledge of the truth. The truth is Jesus Christ. And we can understand that in him are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And so when we come to know Christ, or even before we learn to come to know Christ, that is, even as children growing up, before they know Christ as a Savior or Lord, they know, they're taught that he is a creator and he is the teacher and he is the one to look up to. And when we understand that, we then don't need to even try to learn for the purpose of proving anything to ourselves or trying to authenticate ourselves or trying to master everything or trying to prove something. When Christ is first, then all other learning becomes a privilege, a joy, an extra, a bonus. And it really is honoring to Christ to pay attention to the world that he has made, to how it works, to his control over history, and so on. And so children learn learning from a learner. And as a learner, we ourselves must possess a certain amount of understanding and knowledge and master. It's fascinating to master something. There's a comfortable feeling in being able to master something. At some point, I mastered the multiplication table through 12. If you ask me what 8 times 9 is, I can say 72. I don't need to think. It's there. And that feels good to have mastered something. It wasn't my choice to do that. I was taught that. And there is a facility. There is an equipping. There's a certain satisfaction that comes from having mastered either a process or some basic factual knowledge like that, or even some other kinds of understanding. As a teacher, you should be able to demonstrate with your children how to play with knowledge. Playing is actually very serious work for children. Probably, if not the most important, some of the most important things children learn, they learn through play. You just watch a child learning how to run or jump or bounce. And some of the things that they do, they get hurt doing them. But experience is a very rapid teacher. And as you play with something, you take that thing you're playing with and you just look at it from various angles. You wonder what would it be like if you did it this way or did it that way, and you play with it. And so as we consider things, maybe it's something like the concept of gravity, let's say. And what is gravity? What would it be like if there were no gravity now? Wouldn't that be wonderful? We wouldn't need any seats in this room. We could just come in whatever position you want to be in. You could just put yourself in that position and relax and let your arms hang. And do you think you could write on paper if there were no gravity? Would you have to have something solid to... you wouldn't need to hold your paper, we know that. But then, see, I'm playing with this idea. When I go to write on it, the paper would go floating on over the next person. And what do you think would happen to your muscle mass if there were no gravity? Would that be a good thing? And you get your children to think about these concepts. That's playing with these concepts. And as you think about this and think about that, it really does open your understanding. And it raises questions and you answer questions. And it actually leads to something we'll talk about later, which is pleasure. Information is to knowledge as sound is to music. Information has its place. Knowledge is a type of understanding, and it takes information to have knowledge. We need some facts. We need to know some things. We need to know that there are countries in the world, and that their countries have things called borders, and they have things called governments, and so forth. And as we learn these facts, and we're able to put them together with knowledge, and as we learn, there's something about being possessed. Let the subject you're studying possess you. A person, if you say he is a person possessed, you can tell that something's gripped that person. He might look like he's a little bit beside himself. He looks like he's possessed. Well, when we're ready to start a class, we should be a bit possessed. That is, you should see to the heart of the lesson that you want to teach and be able to direct the thoughts, the conversation, towards that goal. And so, for example, I remember some years ago discussing a story. It actually was an excerpt from Amos Fortune Freeman that was in a reader that we had, and it was called Auction for Freedom. Some of you might be familiar with that selection. And I remember discussing poverty. There was a family there that had was not able to care for themselves, and so this child was, in a sense, auctioned off. It wasn't really an auction, but that's the way the town took care of the poor. They would give a certain amount of money to a person to care for this poor person for a year. At any rate, that generated a discussion on poverty. And what I wanted to hear these 7th and 8th graders discuss was poverty. And so we generated a list on the chalkboard. What are some reasons that people are poor? It would be fun to have that discussion with you. And some typical ones came out, like, for example, some people have undue amount of sickness or accidents that they can hardly work. But as that discussion went on, I'll never forget that one boy raised his hand, and he said, I think some people are poor because they want to be poor. And that generated a bit of discussion. And your 7th and 8th graders can come up with those kinds of things too. And so as we learn, there are, whether it's a concept in science like photosynthesis, doesn't that sound like a juicy word to talk about? Photosynthesis, putting together, and it gives you something to talk around, to discuss, to try to understand. Learning is studying something is a bridge between the student and the teacher. And if you can get something on the floor, something you're talking about that actually captures the attention of you and the students, you're well on your way to having some good learning take place. If you ever have trouble with classroom management, with students paying attention to behaving, the first thing to do is to try to do a better job of teaching. That picture I showed you of the globe, those people were engaged. The teacher and the students were engaged with a subject. The focus was actually on the globe, the thing that they were studying. You want your students to forget about themselves. You want them to forget about the teacher and to be intrigued with the subject at hand. And so whether it's something in history, for example, how inventions changed. And so, for example, looking back at how the automobile drastically changed society and highways, motels, restaurants, lifestyle. And then we're coming to today. What are some of the changes afoot right now? How does this gadget change the way people think about themselves, the way they relate? And as you get your minds focused on something like that, there's a lot of learning can occur, and there's a connection. I'd like to read a quote from a book. This is a quote from a book called School Management and Moral Training. And in this book, the author says, "Thorough and fresh knowledge not only wins the confidence of pupils, but it also awakens interest, holds the attention, and secures diligence in study. The teacher's interest in the lessons taught begets interest in the pupils. Their interest secures attention, and interest and attention ensure progress." Many a teacher has won the esteem of the school by the fullness of his knowledge, the clearness of his explanations, and the glow of his own interest in the subjects taught. Learning. Let's move on to authority. Yes, we can be learners and enjoy learning, but if we don't exercise authority, the students will still run away from us. And it doesn't matter whether they're kindergartners or seniors. You get the feeling, if you've taught a bit, there's this feeling when you're in authority, your feet are on the ground. You're grounded, and you're kind of managing the room. When the students start to run away with things, you kind of feel like you're being lifted off the ground and kind of shift a little bit, like you're shifting sand. Who knows what I'm talking about? Okay, yeah. So somehow we have to exercise authority. How do you establish and maintain authority? That's the question. Authority does command respect. And this is one of those qualities that can only be practiced in the presence of students. We can be learners, we can have patience, we can have these other qualities, but it's only in the interaction with students that you can actually exercise authority. And the foundation of authority is your mastery of the subject. That is one of the first things, if not the most important thing. Whatever it is, the first law of teaching in Gregory's book is the teacher must know that which he would teach. It's not a very comfortable feeling to be up front and try to explain something that you don't understand, or to be asked a question by a student individually. How do you find this answer? And you look at it and you don't know yourself how to do it. Well, that'll happen to everybody sooner or later. Something will come up that you won't know how to do. But if this is routine for you, it's obviously going to be difficult for you to exercise authority. It depends on you being adept at handling the subject and leading the student along. Being able to be comfortable with the subject and be able to lead them along. Now, I will hasten to say that as you teach, as the years go by, you have different degrees of, quote, handling various subjects. Some subjects, you really have them down, you master them very well. Other ones, you just aren't as adept in. And if that's the case, you have to take a different stance, a different approach in teaching that. And, for example, if you're not very skilled at something, you can take the adventure approach. And the students can know that this is something you're kind of working through with them. And we're going to do this thing. And I'm willing to work hard. You work hard. We'll work hard together, and we'll find our way through. and they'll know that you're hitting some of these rapids the same time they are, and you help them through. And then there are other subjects that you can teach from a different point of view, where you know what's coming, you know the questions, you know the difficulties, and you can even anticipate them. And then when they get there, you can handle them in a different way. Authority requires a conviction of the worth of the subject. Do you really believe that what you're teaching is worthwhile teaching? That it's worthwhile for the students to know it? If it isn't, they will pick it up. Some of the most, one of the most important things for you to do is to care about what you're teaching. If you can't care, do you expect them to care? And that requires you to look at this lesson I'm teaching and find some value in it and teach out of that. That doesn't mean that you tell them necessarily in so many words why this is important, but it does affect your attitude, your stance towards the subject. And it helps to engage the students to aspire, engages their ambition to stretch themselves and to aspire after something. Authority does require a formal distance. That's that question people ask. How do teachers relate to students? Well, you are friendly, but when you're teaching, when the teaching period starts, you do take on the role of a teacher. And it doesn't matter how old or young you are. It doesn't matter if you're even a peer teacher. When you're teaching. And teaching does not thrive in a setting where you're trying to be buddy-buddy. The illustration has often been used that if you were having somebody teach you how to drive a car, you didn't know how to drive a car. So you climb in behind the wheel, and the other person sits on the other side, and you start down the road. And he's teaching you as an instructor. This is not the time for chatting. This is not the time for chit-chat. This is the time to be all business, because that person, if he's going to teach, will tell you about the curves, to slow down. He'll be focusing on the road and what you're doing and all other kinds of chit-chat. It doesn't matter how friendly you are with that person, how well you know them. If they actually indulge in informal chit-chat, they're not a very good teacher. The teaching session is not a good session. Moving on to order. Order fosters harmony. And when you think of harmony, you think of voices in a choir singing in harmony. They complement each other. Each one lends its part, and together there's a fuller voice than there would be with any part by itself. The world is chaotic. And even in science, they tell us, the second law of thermodynamics tells us that all things tend to work towards disorder. Things tend to get disorderly, wear down, wear out, get out of place. And that's also true in our functions. And somehow there's structure imposed on the chaos so that things go well. And children need help to do that. Outer order does help achieve inner order. I think there's probably a pretty direct relationship between the orderliness in a child's desk. If you open the lid and look in the desk and see how things are arranged, I think there's a correlation between that and how things are arranged in the child's mind. And there is a carryover. If you can train yourself to be orderly in the way you do things, you do first things first, important things first, put things in place, a place for everything, everything in its place. It helps you in your thinking, in your relationships, in other ways also. The teacher needs to be one, a person of order. Now, I don't mean systematized, mechanical, machine-like behavior, not at all, but order. And another term could be integrity or integration for that. Structured industry, that is when you are diligent. The scriptural term diligent means not necessarily fast, but up and at it early. Just keeping at your work. Structured industry yields productivity, or you might say satisfying conclusions, completed work, neat work. It's wonderful when you consider the orderliness of the world, the spring, summer, fall, winter, the predictability, and it's amazing how predictable the world is. The sun comes up, the eclipse of the sun coming up here, they can predict down to the second. God has a very orderly world. But look at the vast diversity in this orderly world with the flowers and the branches and the storms and the weather. There's a vast diversity. And that's the same way it can be in the classroom. It takes a certain amount of order, a certain amount of routine, and it's in that routine then that we're free to have variety and spontaneity. It requires you to be perseverant and to have an effective method. Order suggests discipline. When I say discipline here, we think of the disciplines of study. Discipline is a broad word that means that you discipline yourself to be able to focus on something. A disciplined driver stays on the road. In the children's book, the story about Tootle didn't want to stay on the tracks. He wanted to get off the tracks and go out in the fields and smell the flowers. Well, a train is supposed to be disciplined to stay on the track. And when we talk about a discipline of study, when you study history, you discipline yourself to study history, science, and so on. And so discipline is really a positive force. It's a drive to be able to tune out distractions and focus on what's needed in order to achieve what we want to achieve. Order also requires clarity. As a teacher, with your ordered approach to lesson planning, your ordered approach to checking papers, your ordered approach to running classes, does it introduce clarity and purpose by the teacher? And this is where, if you're going to be orderly, remember we're talking about qualities that you can't learn from a book. These have to come from within. An ordered classroom, if it's really an ordered classroom, it comes from an ordered teacher, and an ordered teacher comes from the order in your own heart, in your own life. Are you an orderly person? Remember, when I say orderly, I don't mean mechanical and non-human. I don't mean that you operate like a machine. But it's the opposite of disorder and chaos and inconsistency. Another major word associated with order is consistency. And you find as a teacher, consistency is one of the most difficult challenges to achieve. It's easy to define. It's easy to describe. But you try being consistent and you find out it's quite a challenge. And it develops the capacity in the student to manage the natural confusions. Children face many confusions. They write answers in disorderly ways. They will scribble here, scribble there. And many times, for example, in doing their work in math, the major thing for them to learn is not how to understand how to get the answer to the problem. It's the consistent order in approaching the problem and actually putting into practice what they know to do. And so I'm talking about orderly arrangement of problems on a paper. And if your children are going to be orderly, it's going to have to come from you. And you're not going to get it by telling them on the first day of school to be orderly. It's going to have to happen day by day by day as you work with them. And your consistency fosters respect. We talked about respect earlier with authority. And do they actually respect the work that is set out for them to do. You can stimulate your students by actually revealing some of your personal pursuits. There are things that all of us have, things we're interested in, kinds of things we do outside of school, or at least we should. And as we share these with our students occasionally, we can stimulate them, and they will see that we ourselves are people who follow productive work in our own lives. Maintain standards. Before I move into imagination, I'd just like to, I have a couple quotes here from some students that, some alumni from our school who collected some quotes from each other some years later after they were through school. And this one person said, and that this is, when you teach students, you teach in faith, knowing that someday they will understand. And so some of these quotes were from people who are in their 30s or even 40 years old now. But this one person said, somehow I have developed a huge respect for the discipline evidenced by our school routines, although I had the self-centeredness to resent and even rebel against it some days. And it wasn't until later years that she realized how huge this was. These qualities that children experience coming from you as you manage the room are influential in their later lives in ways beyond what I can describe. And they must come from you. They're not going to get it from the textbook. Let's move on to imagination. What is imagination? How about if I ask a question here? What would you say imagination is? Somebody give us a definition. There's probably at least 10 different definitions here in this room. Somebody give us one.
I think in imagining something, I think that visualizing.
Okay. Visualizing something. That's a very good definition, common definition. Being able to see how something could be done. If you can't imagine how you could do something, do you think you could do it? I can imagine. I can't picture my classroom being orderly. If you can't picture it being, or I can't imagine my students enjoying punctuality. I can imagine them being punctual, but I can't imagine them enjoying being punctual. If you can't imagine them enjoying being punctual, that's a problem. Can you imagine them actually getting lost or getting intrigued by a discussion in history class? Can you imagine such a thing? If you can, good. If you can't, you better exercise your imagination. One of the most important things is for you to be a seer, one who can actually imagine how this could, what would this look like? And how could we possibly get there? From this little booklet, there's a quote here that there is no unimaginative teaching. That is, all true teaching, I think they're saying, requires imagination, both in what it would look like if it's successful and how you might possibly get there. Can you imagine how you could explain to fourth graders that all squares are also rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares? If you can't imagine how you could get that through to them, how would they possibly learn it? And that's certainly one example. So one of the major tasks of the teacher, and this has to come from you, you're not going to get it from a textbook. It's not a method you can learn. You've got to call it forth. Can you imagine? Can you imagine how this could be taught? What this would look like? Well, imagination requires you to identify with the students. If you're going to, can you imagine your students enjoying writing poetry? Can you imagine that? Can you see it? If you can, well, there's a good chance that they can enjoy writing poetry. If you can't imagine it, they're probably not. A few might, because they're kind of strange people, but the rest won't. And so identify, project yourself into their minds. You've got to be able to think like your children thought. I remember being 14 one day. Who remembers being 14? Who has some pleasant memories of being 14? Some do. Who doesn't have pleasant memories of being, well, you don't need to put up your hand. I remember thinking somewhere along one of those years that apparently nobody else ever felt the way I feel at this age, because if they did, they wouldn't treat me the way they treat me. Do you ever think really like that? And there are those years, those awkward years when things are changing fast. And I just substituted this last year for a few days in grades 5 and 6, and it was a delightful experience. And most of my teaching has been in junior high or high school. And I said, told the other teachers afterwards, I said, I forgot what it's like to teach BH. This before the hormones hit. And they're just different people. But you've got to, the group that you're working with, you've got to be able to imagine, to feel like they feel towards that subject. How do you think these students feel when you say, boys and girls, today we're going to learn that there are three classes of levers, first, second, and third, and we're going to learn the difference between each of the three classes. Now, the first class is, how are they going to feel, Bill?
Probably like yawning.
Like yawning? Going to sleep. Yeah, so you've got to remember, think about, how did you feel and how did you struggle when you were there and you had to learn that. And then empathize with them. Somehow help them engage with the subject being taught. If you have difficulty struggling with students' relationships or respect for you, one of the first things to try is to get them engaged with the subject so they aren't even thinking about themselves or about you. Engaged with the subject. And that's... Yes. Let me just say a few more things. Let's see. Yes. Imagination requires hope and vision. There's got to be confidence that we actually can do this. We can do it. Confidence that it can be taught. And it's very demanding. You have to evaluate the attitudes, the character, and of yourself and the students. Many times, teaching a subject or a lesson is only part of what's involved. Oftentimes, an equal part, if not a bigger part, has to do with the feelings and the emotions and the attitudes. I remember helping someone with her math, and you know, you focus on this problem, and you get to the point, you get to that tipping point where it starts to shift from a mathematical problem to a feeling problem. And now when you get past that point, it's not about math anymore. It's all about, well, I can't do this, I can't get it. And now you can talk to your blue about math, but that person isn't even thinking about the math anymore. They're thinking about how hopeless the situation is, and I can't do it. And so you have to be able to deal with that and realize that sometimes the 60 or 70 or 80% of what you're dealing with is the will, the feelings, the attitude, and maybe only 30% is about the math. Other times you're so engrossed with it that it's almost 100% about the math and not about, or at least now the feelings are involved. There's where the feelings are all going for you, but you don't have to try to take them into account to help the person learn. And this is where imagination calls for a balance between plans and spontaneity. So you might imagine something, how something can be done, but then you get into explaining into the project or whatever it is, and something either doesn't go the way you envision it going, or the way it went last year, or the way it's supposed to go, and you have to adjust. Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's going much better than what you expected, and you're able to take off and do more than you anticipated. So imagination requires you to be able to go with the flow. Visualize your students' future. Be able to take the long view. They don't take the long view, and that's okay. They're children. But visualize that these people, what they're learning here is just part of the total package of what they will need or have down the road, and visualize their future. Take the long view. I would say also, hold the long view, but don't push it on them. Let me read a quote here by a student. It's kind of like a little poem. She says, talking about the teacher, "Strong and alert, the captain stands at the prow with wrinkled brow. He gazes ahead, mentally planning the course for the day. Glancing at the sails, he moves around, encouraging and prodding the sailors on. Then back to his room, he pores over maps, checks his compass, sets the course. He cannot force the ship to go where he wants, but he sets the sails and steers the rudder so she follows the course he has set for her. And his character shines out of his life. Years of experience have given him wisdom, but his students must answer life's questions for themselves. He cannot force his students to follow his course, but he asks the questions, guides the discussions, and tells the stories that will get them there." A very apt description of the captain, the analogy here, the teacher being the captain of a ship. And he sets a course for where this room, where the ship will go. But he can't force it, and he doesn't try to push it on the students. But he does have vision. And remember that the unknown, something new. When your students need to read something new, study something new things, at the same time they stimulate interest sometimes, also create fears. Am I going to be able to do this? And so you have to be able to think about how your students may feel and think as you face something new. Your students' confidence is very closely tied to their confidence in the teacher. A scary thing as a teacher is to believe in your students. You must believe them. You can do this. I know you can. And we're not going to quit until you master it. And you know, when you believe for your students and then they do it and are able to master it, they will really respect the work and they respect the one who made them put in the effort that they otherwise would not have put in. However, if you ask them to do something, you say you can do it, and they can't do it, they start losing confidence in you. It's tied to the teacher. And many times, dry material just misses a student's understanding. It somehow doesn't connect. So as a teacher, you have to use your imagination to make the familiar unfamiliar, so that they can think about it. I remember one student was intrigued with the question, "Can you jump as high as your knees?" So you touch your knee. Who thinks you could jump as high as your knees? Anybody in here? Well, then when you realize what that means, you get a yardstick and measure how high your knees are, and then you add that distance to the top of your head and put a mark there on the wall. It's a very simple thing to do, actually. Put a yardstick out from the wall and see if you can jump up and touch it at the top of your head. And you can try that this evening. Some of you might actually try it. Now, if you can if you can get something, just get some idea or something out there for children to think about, why it captures their imagination and it gets them into the subject. Let me read another account here from a student. This was one of those assignments that you give assignments and you hope that some of them work out. Some do, not all do. This person wrote, one of our last assignments for creative writing was a short story. I chose to write a historical fiction piece based on a video you showed us about the persecution of Russian Mennonites by a ruthless man named Makhno and his band in the early 1900s. My story, entitled To Die is Gain, made their sufferings seem worthwhile instead of simply tragic. Your comment to me went something like this, quote, you processed their experiences through your writing. Subconsciously, I wrote about brutality in a way that enabled me to stop questioning God about the evil that occurred. I thought about this many times since. I have written to contend with life and will likely continue to do that. So there's a case where an approach and a type of assignment in response to reading or hearing about something in history was able to help at least some students engage with something in a way that was formative. Let's move ahead to compassion. We heard a bit about compassion this morning. Compassion is not pity. It's not just feeling about something. It actually engages the heart very, very deeply. And it's tied to the concept of eating the inner organs. Scripture talks about being moved with compassion. It actually kind of hurts if you're very compassionate. It hurts in the bowels. The scripture talks about bowels of compassion. Because Jesus, at one time, it said, if you only knew what belonged to you. He saw these people as sheep without a shepherd. He saw them lost, disoriented. And we see students without understanding, without habits, with frustrations. And we know what they need. You can't really give it to them, because the things they really need are bigger than anything you can give. They have to learn it. They have to experience it. And our hearts are moved with compassion. It literally involves suffering with the students. We actually suffer with them. We feel with them. We struggle with them. When your students are frustrated, struggling with something, you also suffer, and you're not frustrated so much, but the struggle to replace ignorance with knowledge, to impose order, it's very difficult. And it actually causes a emotional, physical exhaustion. If you're taught, you know it's possible to get tired teaching in a more tired out way than you get from physical work. Something literally goes out. Virtue goes out. Compassion acknowledges that there is difficulty in reaching high standards. That is, the bar is high. We're actually going to memorize this whole song, and we're going to do it by the end of the month. Or we're going to learn how to solve this kind of equation. And compassion requires you to set goals that are high enough that it actually is a challenge, actually is a struggle, but also reachable. And you're going to have to be able to help them reach those goals. And if we're compassionate, we correct our students, we rebuke them or correct them in a way that actually builds their dignity and self-respect. And, for example, we might point out how they thought, how their thinking should be different. And yet we respect them as people. As we are devoted to our students, we challenge them, because Without pain, there is no gain. Someone has said that compassion is the most basic of the need of skills for the teacher. There can be no successful practice of the art of teaching without this common experience with the students, without compassion. Jesus, it says, knew what was in man. And as we teach, we need to know also what's in our students, and we understand what they face. One student wrote, "You gave us the feeling that you actually liked us in that awkward time of life." You need to learn to like your students. And you know the story of the butterfly. The butterfly has to struggle to get out of its chrysalis. And if you are too helpful and rip the chrysalis open, the butterfly will never fly. And so these children, as they go through this struggle, this awkward struggle of life, it's something we all must go through. And you must learn to like them. Patience, another quality, provides persistence. This is a virtue that actually must be, okay, calls for restraint. It provides hope over despair, is the way one person worded it. It's an active virtue, and there's the determination there to help students learn. And patience recognizes life is difficult, learning is difficult, but we're going to pursue this work. And many of these other qualities require somewhat of a release. That is something that comes out of us. We exhibit pleasure. We exhibit passion or interest. Patience requires a restraint, kind of a holding of it in, holding it in. And you know, if students are to learn to be patient, they're going to learn it through your patience as a teacher. It gives them time to learn. But remember, children are children, and there's a difference between the playful fancies of a child's imagination that actually stimulate thought and foolishness that opposes learning. So we're not patient with foolishness, we're not patient with unkindness, with disrespect, but we are patient with children as they are children. Keep sight of the goal. Harness your hopes that you have for them to the condition that they're in. If they can't move on, they can't move on. And you need to be patient and explain, repeat, help, whatever is needed. And refuse to despair. Move ahead into the night, that is, into the difficulties that you face. Moving to character. Character requires you to be authentic, requires authenticity. Consider and use your own mental and moral qualities to the best advantage. You can't be somebody that you are not. You can't replace authenticity with new methods. This is a fascinating subject. You can't be somebody you are not. Think of David being careful not to take on Saul's armor. He knew it wouldn't fit him. Maintain a proper stance. When you teach, you're at a certain age. When I started teaching, I was like an older sibling to my students. Eventually, I was more like the age of a parent. And then the last year is like a grandparent. And you have to be who you are. Don't try to be somebody that you aren't. Be yourself. And allow your own traits to show and use them for good effect. Learn to know who you are as a person. Are you a storyteller? Are you a questioner? Are you a slow, methodical person? Are you quiet? Are you voluble? Are you introvert, extrovert? All kinds of people can be teachers, and you can teach out of who you are. Learn to know who you are and teach out of who you are. Use your knowledge tied to passion for the subject and technique linked with personal experience. And passion does not necessarily mean that you're jumping around, but it means that you're really taken, you're really possessed, as I said earlier, with the subject. Uphold accuracy and honest struggle in your students. Be approachable and interested in your students' lives in a healthy way. And encourage your students to grow independent of you as a teacher. That is, they shouldn't be dependent on you to find all the answers to solve every problem that they face. And as you age, become the person you are. Your character should be real and distinct. Don't try to be somebody that you aren't, and don't be afraid to be who you are. God made you the way you are, and cultivate those qualities of character that are helpful in the classroom. Don't try to play a false role. Don't try to be somebody else. Now, you can learn from other people, but you have to take the things you learn and make them your own and develop into the teacher that you're meant to be. There is such a thing as putting on your garb for teaching. Now, I'm not really talking about how you dress, although you should dress well, but more the attitude, the language, the spirit, the kind of the mind of the teacher as you step into the role of being teacher. And then detrimental characteristics. If you have a habit of being late, of being excess, if you really like to crack jokes, leave some of them outside the classroom. There's opportunity for laughter in the classroom without trying to manufacture artificial humor. And last but not least, set your face steadfastly to the work. And like Jesus said, his face steadfastly to Jerusalem. Pursue it. A few comments on pleasure. Pleasure offers satisfaction. There actually is pleasure in learning. Pleasure opens the doors to the mind and the heart. It's maintain a serious mind and a light heart. When we say serious, we mean we actually have a job to do and we're going to get the job done. But that doesn't mean we need to be dour or down at the mouth or sour about it. We could say that I talked about play before. Study involves intellectual play in which students are invited to join. And sometimes, think of young children, sometimes laugh for the sheer joy of being alive. Do you remember those days? Remember seeing a child just laughing out of the pleasure of splashing in a mud puddle? Well, there's that kind of pleasure, just splashing in the field of knowledge and just seeing how something works and just imagine that. If a diameter, is a line, is a line infinitely long? Well, yes. Is a ray infinitely long? Yes. Is every line twice as long as a ray? Well, yes, no? You can decide. Isn't that kind of interesting just to ponder that? Truth opens possibilities to new understanding. And, sorry, I need to finish up here. Teachers receive pleasure from student achievements, conquest of challenges, and fresh combination of ideas. There is pleasure in seeing students learn. And some of the greatest pleasure comes from mastering hard work. And when you're able to help your students develop their abilities and shine, show your students that true knowledge satisfies the thirst for understanding and that knowledge requires painful effort. There is a joy in learning, and there is a deep, settled satisfaction in working hard and applying. May God give us grace to apply these qualities that we call out of ourselves. Thank you. You're dismissed.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.